Hey, hey, this is Cedric, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And before we get into this deep, insightful, and philosophical conversation with Knut Svanholm, the author of Sovereignty Through Mathematics, Independence Reimagined, and his latest masterpiece, Bitcoin, Everything Divided by 21 Million, I want to tell you about our fantastic sponsors. Secure your Bitcoin from physical disaster and a single point of failure with a CipherSafe seed storage device. CipherSafe's goal is to provide important, tangible security tools for Bitcoin. CipherSafe focuses on securing your Bitcoin with beautiful, elegant, and practical devices. Designed, engineered, and manufactured all in-house. Machined from solid stainless steel, not stamped out. Waterproof, fireproof, and rustproof. The Cipher wheel is designed to be physically locked with a padlock and comes with a tamper evidence seal, so you can be aware of any attempts to steal your seed words. To keep your sats safe, go to ciphersafe.io and use the code MATRIX to get 10% off your order. Ledin is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. Ledin.io is the first digital asset lender with the transparency and security of a formal proof of reserves attestation. You can borrow against your Bitcoin if you don't want to sell, or you can use their B2X program if you want to take advantage of this sideways price action and double your stack. Listeners of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast get $10 free in USDC when you become a Ledin user and take out a Ledin loan today. If you want to see what it's all about, head over to start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Knut Svanholm, the Bitcoin philosopher.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Knut Svanholm's books are best described as guided meditation that soothe the experienced and tutor the uninitiated in the ways of Bitcoin. Knut used to have a fiat life as a ship captain, and now you may choose him as the captain of your Bitcoin space arc to navigate the stormy seas of fiat imposition and swells of cognitive dissonance. Grounded in logic and unbounded in spirit, Knut offers something for everyone. We have plenty of pessimism and outright nihilism in the Bitcoin scene, and Knut, using his quick wit and humor, whips up a fresh gust of positivity and optimism to disperse the clouds of misery, letting the rays of infinite optionality, prosperity, and love shine through. Knut is the author of Bitcoin, Everything Divided by 21 Million, Sovereignty Through Mathematics, and Independence Reimagined. Knut, welcome back to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Thank you, Cedric. Very nice to be back. I'm doing great. Love to be back on the show.
Well, it's great to have you back. I think this is the fourth time. So I think you're tied for the lead now. And we did get to meet in between the first three and this fourth in Miami at Bitcoin 2022.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, a great magical experience. We got to spend some time on a rooftop, a roof deck overlooking Miami and chat. And, you know, you handed me your new book, Bitcoin, Everything Divided by 21 Million. And, you know, your books, the others, have been really, you know, really huge and influential in my life. And this book, you know, I read it while my father was passing away. And thank you. And this book was my companion piece. And like your others, it's very philosophical and it got me to contemplate a lot of different things. I thought this one, they all really blow me away, but I thought this one had a slightly different tone. I think you were, I don't know if it was more conviction or more direct. I don't think those were the right words, but I think you would maybe in some way, maybe speaking to a broader audience. But I just found it more to be more of an opus, a summation, if you will.
More of a book than a pamphlet, which is what the last ones were.
I just think it was written maybe because I'm different when I read it. I think it's more probably what happened. And having read the other two, you know, you go into a book prepared for it. But it really struck me a lot. And one thing I've been thinking a lot about since our last conversations and reading the book is what you were doing before Bitcoin. And I'm kind of curious what your experiences were like as a deck officer on a tall ship sailing the world.
It sounds more glamorous than it was. We were sailing around I wouldn't say the world, but we were sailing around the Atlantic and the Mediterranean and the North Sea with high school students on board. And the setup was like 6 days at sea, 6 days in some port. Obviously, that wasn't the case all the time. When we crossed the Atlantic, for instance, you're like out for 20 days in a row and stuff like that. But it was a very laid back job. I was responsible for the safety equipment on board and the sea charts. We still had paper charts and we had both electronic and paper charts. But so that was my two main tasks, apart from just keeping the watch during my 4 hours during the day and my 4 hours during the night. And like in each port, we were there for 6 days, and there was one master and two officers on board. So we took 1 day each, took the watch for 24 hours. Like, so you stayed on board 1 day and then you were free to do whatever you wanted the other two days. I think it was intended that we were supposed to work 1 day, or like be on watch 1 day, work 1 day, and then be free 1 day. But of course, I tried to do all the other stuff I had to do during my watch day. So I was basically free for 4 days and worked for 2 days in each port. And like, well, I didn't make a lot of money, but it was a lifestyle that I enjoyed. And like, when you do that for a long time, you start really feeling that you lack a purpose in life, or like that your life isn't really, there's no vector pointing anywhere. You're just doing this laid back stuff all the time and not really getting anywhere. And the thing with the tall ship is that it was a bit too small for me to get anywhere certificate wise. Mm. So I never got my master's certificate or anything like that. But I had the university diploma, but never got the certificate because of the ship not weighing enough. Like it needed to be above 500 gross tons or for me to get anywhere in life. But since I enjoyed it so much, you know, bypassing the dark, cold Swedish winter and being in the West Indies instead, I saw no reason to aim for anything else at that period, at that time. So it wasn't until I met my wife, which I did on board the tall ship. She was working as a watch leader there. So she had nowhere to run. So we met there, and like then when I got the kids, I realized I need to start working my ass off if I want to like do something with this life before it's too late and get a career. Yeah. So I got a job ashore eventually. But first I got a job on a smaller boat and started working in offshore wind, and then got a job at the office and got to I became the HR manager or the crewing manager. Which was just one level below the owners for quite a big company. Mm-hmm. So I had the responsibility for 250 employees. Mm-hmm. And I did that for like close to 2 years. And then I quit because this Bitcoin thing was taking over gradually. And I felt like I'm throwing my life away if I don't like... if I don't try. At least I need to try to do something with this Bitcoin thing. Having already written two books at that point, and they were getting a lot of attention. So I thought, well, I'll give it a shot. So I quit my job. I took the car, drove down to Spain, where we had a holiday home, and we moved in here. And I started doing Bitcoin things full time, or whatever you may call it. I don't really know what full time is anymore, because I'm like, I don't really have a daily schedule as I used to. And the plan, I had that plan in the beginning, like I'm going to make myself a schedule and be really disciplined and stuff. But then, of course, you don't have to. So, so you sort of start, you let stuff just, you go with the flow a lot more when you're doing your own thing. But so I set up a company and signed a book deal with a publisher, and done a couple of things, working on a website to sell the unlimited version of that limited edition t-shirt you have on, and other stuff. And like, I started doing a bit of seminars and speaking at some conferences here and there, and trying to do more. Well, I guess the main purpose is to have more and more interesting conversations, because I really, really enjoy these philosophical Bitcoin conversations, and like following these thoughts wherever they may lead to, because they're so rewarding and so interesting to follow, and to the rabbit hole is deep, and it consists of a whole bunch of sub caverns that are yet unexplored. So I want to explore them all, basically. Yeah.
Well, it's very interesting, and there's a lot that I relate to with what you said, and I see similarities in my own journey. It's really interesting. I want to go down this rabbit hole of time. You brought up time a lot there, and it is the first chapter in your book. And it's interesting, maybe in our earlier parts of our life, we feel an abundance of time. I think of my kids a lot. They always have a lot of time on their hands. They're always trying to figure out how to spend their time. I think, you know, as we leave fiat, maybe you and me, we have maybe more time on our hands again. What is the difference between killing time and wasting time?
Oh, yeah, that's a section. It's a bit far-fetched, but I put it in the book anyway, because I like the analogy. Like, you're a hunter on the prowl for time to kill. And it's when you find time to kill, that's your prey, and you get to kill it, and you get to hunt it and hunt it down and kill it yourself. And that's really a big part of what life is about. But you have to be careful, because there are others out there who want to waste your time instead of letting you kill it. That little thought thread became a section of the new book. I have to say, I don't remember all of the conclusions that I make in that section. But the point is, time that you decide over, like when you control your time, that's like the ultimate value. Everything else in life, everything, every material thing, or every luxury, or every thing you acquire, you do so with the end goal of freeing up time for yourself. Every tool and every technology ever invented by man has the same purpose, if you really boil it down to what it is. And it's from the screwdriver to this Zoom call, to your automobile, to your mobile phone, whatever, they all have the same purpose, and it's to save someone time somewhere. And if you own all these things and you live in 2022 and there's an abundance of technology and improvements are all around you, and you work more hours than someone did 50 years ago, there's obviously something wrong with that system you're living in, because you ought to be working a lot less since you have all these gadgets and tools to help you save up time. But the reason that you work more and more is because you're being robbed of your time all the time. Every transaction ever made with fiat money is intervened by a third party. There's a third party leeching off the value of every transaction that is ever made in fiat money, which is almost the entire world economy, of course. And someone is stealing that value by running the money printers. So Bitcoin is like the first time we've had an actual fair representation of the scarcity of every person's time on this earth, because Bitcoins are as scarce as human lifetime.
Yeah.
And the first chapter in the book, I realized this after writing the chapter. I re-listened to a book I really like that's called This Book Will Save You Time by Misir Mahmudov, if you know that book. And I realized that my first chapter in this book was very influenced by that book. So I'd like to take the opportunity to do a shout out to Misir and thank him for that book. And if you haven't read it, do, because it's very eye-opening about how time is stolen from you all the time by social media platforms and like ads on the internet competing for your attention. Your attention is part of your time. And there are so many things. If you take the lockdowns and the mask mandates, the COVID measures, and you add up all the extra time, the antigen tests, the PCR tests, the extra time in lines at the airport. If you add up the cost of all that and denominated in just man hours, you can quickly see that you kill more people than you save by just stealing their time. So, and in this sense, time theft is a partial death sentence. If someone steals your time, and time is money, with Bitcoin, time literally is money. If someone steals your time, they're stealing a part of your life. So it's a partial death sentence in that using that framework. Maybe it sounds a bit harsh, but I can't think of an easier way to explain how serious the issue of inflation is. Because it's stealing part of your time, which is a partial death sentence.
Right. Yeah, I mean, death is an interesting aspect of time. It was interesting spending these last few weeks with my father, who was passing away, and how we chose to spend time. And I thought a lot about wasting and killing time in the sense of killing time is when you're doing something you want to by choice. So you exactly. And me, let's go get a meal, let's go kill some time. Versus someone wasting your time or even wasting your own time. And I thought a lot about.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
perfect.
Yeah. And so I kind of wanted to ask you, what if we could live forever? What would that do to our perception of time and its value?
Yeah, this is also in the book because I view the thought of an afterlife as existential inflation in that sense, because one of the conclusions of the book makes is like that the only thing that is giving our time value is the scarcity of it. So if you imagine that you would live forever and that you were indestructible, so you wouldn't die. In such a scenario, you could always postpone every action until tomorrow, because you would have an infinite amount of time on your hands, which means that you wouldn't have to act at all, which means that this preceding value judgment that every human action has wouldn't occur. So every action we take is preceded by a value judgment. We value one action over another. The example I gave Max Kaiser the other month was right now I'm valuing this conversation with you more than I value going and making myself a sandwich in the kitchen. But we make these little micro decisions all the time. Whenever we act on purpose, purposeful action is always preceded by a value judgment. And we all have these value hierarchies in our heads. And like I said, if we had unlimited time, we wouldn't value our time on this earth as much. And I think in this sense, the central bank has taken over the mantle from the organized religions by printing more time for people. Or it isn't really more time. It's a fake representation of it. But more money means that people think that there is more time around. So a normal money printer is just taken over from the existential money printer that used to exist. I mean, the existential money printer that psychopathic leaders could use, they could use that to fool people to go to war because they believe they could get like 20 virgins in heaven and stuff like this. If they just did this, sacrifice themselves for the greater good of the collective, the wonderful collective, they would have a better life in the life after this one. And that was a horrible thing to say to anyone, but what we're effectively doing today, or what the central banks are doing today, is even worse in a way, because they're saying you can have all these things, just take out this big mortgage and shackle yourself to this indebtedness for the rest of your life, and don't worry about your kids or your grandkids, they won't get anything, they'll be poor and happy. It's the same thing, except they can make you do atrocious things to not only other tribes, but to yourselves.
Right.
To ourselves. We voluntarily stay on these hamster wheels in this rat race for 8 hours a day, every day of our lives, until we can't work anymore. And for what? Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, my father was one of those people who really, you know, kind of worked himself to death kind of thing. I think that was a trope of men and women of yesteryear. You broke your back to, you know, kind of pull for your family. And yet I really struggle with this conversation around killing and wasting time, where there is time I want to kill, meaning, i.e. waste. I want to watch a not. I'll watch a movie or sit on a bench and look at a lake or go to the beach. And, I struggle with that notion.
But that's not rigidity. Wasting. Killing and not wasting.
Right. But that's sort of that internal, that way I've been, you know, that we've been taught to think about time, where I'm like, oh, I'm not doing anything right now. And I think about this tweet thread I read where they went and visited this island off the coast of Africa that's kind of untouched by civilization. And they hunt 3-4 hours a day, and then the rest of the day is very leisurely. And we're, like you were saying, we're robbed of that in our sort of our modern world of just being able to enjoy each other or enjoy ourselves our time.
Yeah. Most mammals are like that. If you watch a flock of deer or something, most of the day, they just stand around looking at things and not minding their own business, while we are stressed. Our stress levels are way too high in fiat life. And speaking of fathers, my father passed 2.5 years ago.
I'm sorry.
He taught me a lot. He taught me a lot about, you know, work ethics in that sense. And as you say, I think that generation, they had a lot of work ethics that a lot of people don't have today in that sense, but they seldomly took the time to stop and ask themselves why, I think. And a lot of them had a lot of the boomers had the attitude and still have the attitude of, you know, spend it all while you can and don't think about the future, because you never know what, like, saving up for the future is pointless. And this is what fiat tells you. Since you're getting robbed every month anyway, and you can't predict because the rules change all the time, many people don't see the value in a more long-term outlook on life. And they think it's about spending. And if spending means spending time with your friends and family, then it is about spending. But like, it's not about spending or wasting your time.
Right.
Yeah.
What is absolute mathematical scarcity then? And why is it so important to understand that it was a discovery and not an invention?
Because this is the key insight to understanding Bitcoin, I believe, and to avoid falling for the shitcoin scams. And it's this notion that like, I'll try to keep this short, but I need to backtrack a while because this is tied into my childhood and discovering computers for the first time. And when I got my first computer, was a Commodore 64, and you hooked it up to your TV and you could code the language called BASIC. The programming language was called BASIC, and you could write a little program that said like 10 print hello and 20 go to 10. And the screen would print hello, 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 hello over and over again. And that was an epiphany in a way. The first time I encountered the infinite copyability of everything on a computer. You could just copy everything over and over again. And as computers got better and better and the internet happened and the rise of MP3s and later on video files and now social media and everything, you can see that there's like, the copyright laws of the past are completely outdated. And the notion of infinite copies has ruined many of the old truths we took for granted in the 20th century. And like the superstar pop star is almost gone because they can't sell CDs anymore. And like you have to have something else to name. Anyway, and the movie stars, they're gone too, right? Nobody gives a crap about Hollywood anymore. At least no one interesting does. So we're entering a new paradigm in that sense. And that's when Bitcoin happened and when I came to this realization that this is the discovery of resistance to replicability. Mm. There's something on the internet that you cannot copy. And trying to copy it, well, you can copy the code, but you can't copy the network effect. And that's like, that means that these things that tries to be copies of it or try to invent the wheel again, if you will, they will never be the same thing because either this works and then you have discovered resistance to replicability or it doesn't work and you haven't discovered it. And it certainly seems like Bitcoin is the discovery of resistance to replicability. And over a long enough time frame, it's very easy to see that what Bitcoin is just an agreement on a fixed set of rules. So we all agree that this is the way it works. And if we don't agree, we don't need to agree. But then if we don't, we can run another program. But then again, we don't get to reap the rewards that those people that are in agreement get to reap. That was a long sentence. But so this is why resistance to replicability was a discovery rather than an invention. And when you start to frame it like that, it becomes a much, much bigger thing than just a simple program or a simple platform or a simple protocol. It's because all of those can be replaced by something else at some point in the future, and you can't replace this. This is many Bitcoiners are reluctant to use the word inevitable, and I say Bitcoin is not inevitable, but it's as inevitable as the circular shape was for being the best shape to construct wheels.
Right.
So Bitcoin is the inevitable in that sense to being the only money we will ever need.
Right. If the greatest minds in the world were spending their time trying to reinvent the wheel, that'd be kind of a waste of that brain power.
There is a slight percentage that they find something better.
Sure.
But I wouldn't bet on it.
Right. But it kind of, in terms of, you know, replication or reinvention, without trying to compare gold to Bitcoin, we can kind of look to gold for a little bit of a framework with the alchemists. And sort of, I mean, they were trying to reinvent gold or replicate gold, if you will. And there seems to be a paradox there. Like, what if they were successful at being able to do this? What would that have meant?
Yeah. This is the next chapter in the book, and it's about alchemy. And it was very much inspired by a talk that a German guy called Jörg Hemsdorf held at the Value of Bitcoin conference 2 years back. And I'm trying to popularize the idea because I like it so much, and I have my own angle on it. Because what the alchemists of old should have been looking for are the properties of gold rather than gold itself. But because if they had found a way to make cheap gold out of cheaper base metals, they would have, in doing so, they would have destroyed the value of gold. Because if you could make gold out of tin, for instance, then gold would sooner or later be worth whatever tin is worth, because gold has a higher stock to flow ratio than tin does, right, which is the only thing or the main thing that it derives its value from. Meaning that if the price of gold goes up, then more gold miners try to find gold faster. But they won't, no matter how many resources they allocate into trying to find new gold, they won't find that much new gold because there's not that much new gold left in the ground to find, which means that there's a big stock of gold already found, and the flow of new gold onto the market won't be that much higher, even though the more resources will be allocated to it. So a price rise in gold will not immediately lead to the price of gold sinking again because we find much more of it, which is not true for many other cheaper base metals. So what Bitcoin is basically a reverse engineered chemical element. So you take, if you take the properties of gold or and you condense them and you refine them into what properties made gold good money, and is there anything we could improve on here if we were to do something as outlandish as trying to reverse engineer a chemical element? And the biggest flaw that gold has is its weight. It's very heavy. So in if we imagine an element without weight, without mass, then we can't have any protons or neutrons. It will have to be something made out of only fundamental particles and only electrons. So if it has weight, we couldn't send it over the internet. So Bitcoin is in this sense an informational element where in which when you find when you can prove that you found the location of the element, you've found the element. The information about the element is the element. There is no distinction between the two. And in that sense, knowing is owning in Bitcoin. If you know the Bitcoin private key, you own the Bitcoin. Knowing and owning are the same things. And here we get into yet another sub cavern of the rabbit hole that is extremely unexplored.
Yeah. There's a lot around knowing is owning that you do explore in the book. And one way, I'm kind of curious, like how is Bitcoin the map? Or, you know, in Bitcoin, the map is the territory.
Yeah. This is the genius of proof of work, because with everything else in the universe, including mathematics and everything, the map can never be the territory. An accurate description of the universe would have to be the universe itself. Mm. And there are mathematical proofs that this is so. Gödel's incompleteness theorem, for instance, states that maths can't describe everything. And like there are many aspects of this where there's no other example of something in reality where the map defines the territory. But in Bitcoin, that is the case, because Bitcoin mining is a map in a way. Like the difficulty is the difficulty adjustment algorithm states what difficulty the mining has at a certain point in time. And this is a number starting with a whole bunch of zeros. And exactly how many zeros that is the current difficulty to find the next Bitcoin block. And this number is set in such a way that it takes, on average, 10 minutes to find the next block, regardless of when it occurs. Like, or this is what the difficulty is. So in that sense, Bitcoin creates its own clock, because it couldn't have a central clock somewhere, because then you would have to trust the central server to keep track of time, and Bitcoin wouldn't work. It would have a single point of failure. But since it creates its own clock, it doesn't have a single point of failure. So so in that sense, that's what I mean by the map defines the territory. And Gigi, Dergigi has a very nice explanation of this, a little, you can probably find it on his website, a little infographic on how this works.
Right. I want to read a piece from your work that really sort of hit hard with terms of on time. Long-term thinking is a luxury for those that can afford it. Few today can, since the rules of every nation change over time. New laws are written and new rules come into play every day. This phenomenon alone forces us to adopt a higher time preference, to think more short term. The fear of losing what we have makes us more irrational and egoistic. When we first lay our hands on something that cannot be taken away from us, we can allow ourselves to be less self-centered, less fearful. When we're less afraid, we can prioritize the well-being of ourselves and our families. What is the opposite of fear? It's love. So that was a piece of yours that really, within the book, that really affected me. It made me think a lot about, just especially around when you get your first Satoshis. It's not about how much you have, but now you finally have something that can't be taken away from you. And the spin that you put on is it you know, makes you less self-centered. You own something, but you're now less concerned about yourself.
Yeah, which is counterintuitive to many people, I think, because when you think of someone with a lot of money, you think of Uncle Scrooge or someone like that, like swimming in money. But this is, greed is another thing. Time preference is more about, it's not so much about comparing yourself to others, but comparing yourself to yourself and how many resources you had yesterday. Because we, like, imagine that you're robbed of, a highway robber steals everything you have. Then your priorities become finding food and shelter. You cannot, in order to survive, you need to focus on those things. And you cannot afford to do this in any other way than like the first way available. So if that's being criminal, you're going to be criminal and you're going to steal something, you know, just in order to survive, because you need to, otherwise you die. You don't have the luxury of options. And well, if a thief does this to you, it happens once, and then you can, when you've accumulated resources again, you can rearrange your life and you can reprioritize and spend more money on security, if you will. Like maybe you buy a watchdog or a gun or like a fence around your house, whatever. Anyway, you can prepare for something like that to happen again. And the robber, the thief, is very unlikely to do it to you again, because he knows that you'll probably be better prepared next time. For the taxman or for the central bank, this is not true, because they can do it over and over and over and over again. And not even your peers will help you fight them, because most of your peers will think that they are the morally sound ones because they got elected. So because of some arbitrary popularity contest between psychopaths, you can now not trust your neighbor anymore to see who the real robber is. And even more so for central banks, because hardly anyone sees like banks and central banks as criminal institutions, but that's what they are. They get to counterfeit money. If anyone else did that, they get thrown in jail tomorrow. You know, if you try to use a fake dollar bill, there's only a certain few privileged members of society get to do that. And only those closest to this circle, they are like, they're the shepherds that get to do whatever the hell they want with the herd. They own everyone else until everyone else discovers Bitcoin, and then that ownership ends. Right. So that's the thing. And when we find Bitcoin and we can once again see that we have a set of rules that will not change, that we can adapt to, and we can start accumulating capital and think more long term, then we can afford to be less fearful. And I couldn't think of anything better as the opposite of fear than love. Mm. And I got a lot of inspiration from Jeff Booth in that thinking in that those terms.
Right.
Yeah, shout out to Jeff. Yeah, Jeff has been such a great help with this book, and like I'm right. So honored that he wrote the foreword for it and helped me with it so much.
Yeah, Jeff wrote the foreword, which is tremendous, and he painted a really interesting picture there, or wonderful picture. Your families got together in Spain.
Yeah, we did.
What was that evening like?
It was a surreal evening because, like, I had just moved down here, or my family had just moved down here, and I had convinced my wife that quitting my Fiat job was a good idea, and all this stuff, which. It's not easy, and it's a big decision. And then just a couple of weeks after that, I get this SMS from Jeff saying, like, we had done a couple of pods together before that, but we never met in real life. And he was traveling through Europe with his family, and he said, I'm coming over. So, and my mother was here at the time as well. So we had dinner here at my house, and I grilled some steaks, and we stayed up till like 3 o'clock at night, just chatting away. And when Jeff starts to talk to you, he like you're having this courteous conversation or more shallow conversation with everyone else in the family, just chit chatting, and then all of a sudden he. Starts his laser eyes turn on, and his laser eyes turn starts staring you in your eyes, and just tells you a bunch of, I mean, he's like Gandalf level wise these days, you know. So I got a lot away from that. My younger brother called him like that. It sounds just like you had the experience of having an older brother for the first time, and that's what it felt like. Jeff feels like my older brother. And he's a great inspiration, and I'm so fortunate to have had that experience, and then having him help me out with the book so much. So if you're listening, Jeff, thanks again for everything.
Yeah,
I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I mean the foreword was great, and it was interesting. He mentioned how everything starts with an idea. And I wonder if Satoshi was an alchemist. Was he a chemist? You know, did he create element zero? Did he replicate gold?
That's the thing. About Satoshi and Satoshi's disappearance, a lot of Bitcoiners say that he was altruistic in disappearing, and he did this with this or that intention. But the reality is we cannot know what intentions Satoshi had. His true intentions are unknowable. We have no idea. We have no idea if he's still out there, if he's still, you know, making money, a ton of money off of Bitcoin. He doesn't need to spend his old coins to do that. You know, he could be in whichever other anonymous user with a whole bunch of Bitcoin. I mean, we have no idea. All we know is that the system works. Like, we don't know who Pascal was either. Well, maybe Pascal is a poor example. We don't know like many of the old mathematicians of ancient Greece. We cannot know what they're like. Pythagoras is the guy, the name I'm looking for. We don't know what Pythagoras was like in person.
Yeah,
we
but Satoshi was interacting with a system that I can't comprehend, that no known centralized actor can't trace, i.e. the state. You know, Pascal wasn't interacting with a digital ledger of information, if you will, or no. The internet.
No.
It's just the untraceability of Satoshi is, to me, not human-like. But well, doesn't prove that he's not traceable, and that he won't or she won't rise, or, you know, spend coins or is spending coins. I agree with you 100% that this person could be walking the earth and chilling out, and I get that.
I suspect that there's a high probability that this person is dead.
That's my suspect. Yeah,
that's the easiest explanation, and the easiest explanation is very often the correct one. I try not to fall for conspiracy theories. I think incompetence can be explain mm-hmm. most of the phenomena in the world. I think that Satoshi being dead is a very plausible explanation for his disappearance over such a long period of time.
Yeah, I think I agree there as well. I do think Satoshi's dead. It's just that further compounds for me the unlikely coincidental nature of creating the most important technology invention or discovery, if you will, for discovery for humankind, and then coincidentally, just because of timing, not living to see it out for whatever reason. And I think that's just a whole different rabbit hole. Kind of speaking to what
I've heard many interesting theories about who Satoshi is, and different degrees of plausibility, but but I've heard some interesting, really interesting ones. I mean, a good conspiracy theory can be very entertaining, regardless of if it's true or not.
Right.
But I'm not gonna say anything. I'm gonna stick to my guns here and say that he's probably dead.
Yeah.
But we can't know.
So let's stick to the math, and I think you throw out a number in the book that was astonishing, around how many dollars were printed per Bitcoin issued in 2021.
Yeah, this is this is one of the few ideas in the book that I did not steal. Mm-hmm. because I actually did the maths here, and I heard that it was something absurd, like $8 trillion, and when you divide that by how many seconds there are in a year, it's $222,000 per second. So, and then I thought, how many seconds does it take to create a Bitcoin? And since the block reward is 6.25, you get a Bitcoin every 96th second on average. Which means that if you take 222,000 and times 96 seconds, you get something around $21 million per Bitcoin, which is a very poetic number indeed. During 2021, $21 million per Bitcoin. And to me, this is, if we're just seeing Bitcoin as a, if you're new in this space and you just see it as a, you're just about to grasp this binary bet that either Bitcoin dies or it goes to something absurd. Remember that $21 million were printed per Bitcoin in 2021, and they will print more dollars at a faster rate in the future, and they will print mine fewer Bitcoin at a slower rate in the future. So $21 million per Bitcoin in a not too far distant future is a modest estimation of the price.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's just astonishing. And when you look at this through the lens that you've put on this around morality. So first touching on energy, I mean, you said something around sooner or later, you run out of other people's money. When I think about money printing in a simple
form. That's Margaret Thatcher. That's Margaret Thatcher's quote about socialism. The problem with socialism is that sooner or later you run out of other people's money.
Right. So you could. I read that in your book. Yeah. And I really dwelled on that for a minute. But when I think about money printing, I think about it as in simple form, just pulling time from the future till now. So time we haven't even experienced, or our children's time, or however it may be, just pulling time forward. Spending it on someone's behalf who's going to benefit, maybe retain those assets, but you know the time is spent. And these are your words from around morality: is belief in a life after death is much more common than a belief in a life before birth because it is comforting. But what does a belief in an afterlife do to our psyche? It dilutes the value of our time on earth. Existential inflation or existential money printer that can fool people into believing that this or that arbitrary thing is true. To someone who wishes to control your actions, this is very convenient. And I remember, you know, we were taught divine right in school, and we kind of learned about a king, you know, kings, kingdoms in Europe. But you know, you touch on how belief in an afterlife is a great tool for control.
Yeah,
and you go on to say that today's collective belief systems dupe populations into immoral behaviors through more sinister means. And we touched on it earlier on how democracy has replaced organized religion. And you go on to say the will of the people has replaced our moral code. And I wonder there, will social credit scores replace democracy and our therefore our moral code going forward?
I really hope not. Because social credit scores, they are happening, and they are happening because of KYC, basically. They're connected to KYC, and know your customer policies. So whenever you buy something with your credit card or your debit card, you pay with much more than just your money.
Mm.
You pay with your information and your you pay with your spending habit timeline, if you will. And this is very valuable information to anyone that wishes to control you in any manner. Like, so it's very convenient for anyone who wishes to sell you something, but it's also convenient for a government that wishes to control you. If everyone was running their own Bitcoin node and using their own Lightning node for payments, it would be much harder to implement these policies anywhere. And I think they do way more harm than good, because they're advertised as being there to combat money laundering. But like, the whole purpose of money is to be able to facilitate trade with someone that you don't have to trust. So someone which you don't know, the customer that you don't know. This is why money was invented in the first place. It could act as a medium of exchange between people who didn't know each other. People who knew each other could interact anyway and trust each other. With, if I give you this, you give me something back at this date. If you know the other person, there's no problem that needs to be solved. So money was a solution to that problem. And this is why KYC is so absurd, because the seller does not need the information. The customer does not need the information. A third party does. And ask yourself, why? Why am I giving this information up?
And that information has to be more valuable than the information that Facebook, not maybe more valuable, but just as valuable, if not more than what Facebook and Twitter is gleaming. And they give their services for free. I'm just thinking about in terms of this, it's like they are gathering so much information from us and then charging fees on top of it.
I think
extraordinary fees to use our own money.
The average Facebook user, I read this somewhere, it's worth, you should probably add a bit of inflation to this, but this is like 3 years back, maybe, that the average Facebook user was worth $150 per year to the company, which means that they you should only give up that amount of information about yourself if you got $150 in return for it every year. Otherwise, you're the loser in that game. You're the product, not the user.
Right. But we're the product in the banking system too. I mean, they're getting a lot of information and then charging fees on top of it that Facebook and Twitter don't even charge.
It's becoming a social credit score system. It exists here as well. And like how much money you make defines
what
interest rate you get on your loan and so on.
Right, which is as valuable as money in a fiat world.
Information is, of course, very valuable in the information.
But even taking loans in a fiat world is valuable because the person with the most loans in a fiat world is the wealthiest. So it's
the winner.
Your credit score is dictating.
But it depends. If you buy Lambos, you might not be the winner. But if you buy assets. If you buy Tesla stock, maybe.
Right.
But
no, if you're buy Elon Musk and you could borrow and get credits, environmental credits. I mean, his reputation, his score in the system gets him a lot of debt to then buy assets or equity.
And this reminds me of a story. I wonder if this is in the book. Maybe it's in another book. I don't remember. But I find so fascinating the first time I heard about it, because Salvador Dali, the famous painter, was once in a car accident in France where he hit another car. And this Frenchman jumps out of the car and starts screaming at Salvador, like, oh, putain merde, sacre bleu. And Salvador simply walks out of the car, twiggles his mustache a bit, and signs the wreckage, instantly turning it more valuable than it was as a new car. Right. So, but there's more to that story. And that is, all the famous painters in the middle of the last century, they did this to their restaurant bills. So whenever they had a large restaurant bill, they, instead of paying it, they just signed the bill. So there's the autograph. It's worth something. And the restaurant owner usually said yes to this, until they did it too much and they inflated the supply of their own signature. So they lost value, so they couldn't do it anymore. And it's a perfect representation of what the Fed is doing, or what any central bank, or even just a normal fractional reserve bank is doing to our money. They're issuing tokens that will lose their value because there's too many of them.
What do you think of that in our physical world? Yeah, if you were a proprietor and without getting into hero worship, but someone you admired their artwork or whatever it was, or someone you knew was a proprietor and was offered a signature in exchange for payment. We're still on a fiat standard, so we're using paper money. Do you think that could have value to another human intrinsically because they value some connection to that artist or that artist's work or that thinker or something?
Well, there's no such thing as intrinsic value. Well, it's all subjective. I have personal experience with this, because I in Miami, one of the best, if not the best aspects of Miami was meeting for the first time in real life my longtime friend and collaborator Fractal Encrypt, which is the greatest living artist in the world today. He is not only like, he is the Da Vinci of art today. Like I was about to say Bitcoin art, but he's so much more than that. And he's very meticulous, and he takes great pride in not diluting his name at all. I mean, he tries to be as anonymous as he can. And he just oozes integrity. And I got to spend a week with him, and I enjoyed every second of it. And I respect him so much. I'm so happy to have met that guy. The story about these infinity keys that are on the cover here is just simply I pinch myself every day trying to wake up from this weird dream where this happened, that Bitcoin Infinity Day became a thing and an art piece that's sold for 1.05 Bitcoin is the final price for the yeah.
What are the Infinity Keys? Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, so it's in the book, this story, but my story with Fractal Encrypt, it starts with me seeing the full node statue for the first time. If you show that Independence Reimagined book cover again, this is the full node statue. And Fractal is making 10 of these. He's making the last one at the moment. And they have evolved over time. A whole bunch of big shots have these things on their walls, including Michael Saylor. And I noticed I think it's the first video he made of one of these things. And that's like 3 years back or something, or 2 years back, maybe, in Miami at some art gallery. It was not during a Bitcoin conference, I believe. But then I saw my book title in one of the circles. So it said Sovereignty Through Mathematics in one of the circles. So I tweeted at him, did you know that that's the, what a funny coincidence. Did you know that that's the title of my book? And it turns out, oh yeah, man, I was listening to your book when I made it. It was an inspiration for the piece. And I'm like, my jaw dropped to the floor. Like, this is so cool. Here's this spectacular artist in Miami doing this thing. And what a weird coincidence. And then he agreed on collaborating on the cover for the next book. And we ended up just using that piece because it's so stunning. So it became the cover for my next book. And fast forward to last year, I had written this article with the sentence, everything divided by 21 million in it, called Deeper Down the Rabbit Hole. And then Yoni Appelberg, another great collaborator, turned that into an animation where you could see this equation that became a thing in the Bitcoin, the equation on your T-shirt. And that turned into a thing or a meme, and it propagated very fast across the internet. And then during my time in Mexico, we had the idea of turning this into a celebration, a date, because infinity divided by 21 is pretty close to 8/21, which is a date if you write dates in the American way. Mm. We write them the other way around here in Europe, as you might know. But that's like the 21st of August. So we figured, what the heck? 21st of August is Bitcoin Infinity Day. We hadn't yet figured out what that was or anything. But I announced it on Tonevay's pod. And just a couple of days after, this was in the beginning of August, and this date was supposed to happen on 21st. So just a couple of days after, Fractal has designed this beautiful, beautiful laser cutout key that said, that looks like this. I don't know if this goes to YouTube. I guess it does. So you can see the thing. Is it mirrored now? I guess it's mirrored. I guess so, yeah.
No,
yeah,
I can read it.
Yeah. Anyway, this originally said, fuck your shitcoin, by the way. So, but it changed it to everything divided by 21 million. And then we brainstormed a bit on what Bitcoin Infinity Day was, and we figured it's a date in which you stack 21 times your normal daily average stack. So that's the current definition of Bitcoin Infinity Day. And so he made these keys, and the first thing he thought, I'm making 21 of these, and I'm giving them out to people who taught me something new about Bitcoin. But then he riffed on the idea with not only me, but a couple of other people. And turns out that, no, I'm auctioning one of them out. And we decided that he should auction out number 8 of 21, because that's a special, that's the date, right? So he did that. And he also made, he made private and public keys. And the public keys have a different background. The private keys have a black background on the little placard they sit on, while the public keys has a glittery background. So he auctioned out this one piece, and then he sold the public keys, and they increased in price with every block that passed during 210 blocks, which is 2.5 days. And he managed to sell exactly 210 of them. So 210 public keys and 21 private keys. The number 8 out of 21 went for 1.05 Bitcoin, worth $67,000 at the time.
Wow.
And I have number 1 out of 21.
Oh, wow.
So
that's awesome.
So and he's, I got it in a box, or got sent to a relative of mine in a box that I like. Yeah, I remember opening the box and telling her what. She had to guess what it was worth. And no, higher. And she got up to like a 20th of its real worth or something. I mean, the whole story is just so amazing to me. And there's an article in Bitcoin Magazine about it. If you search for Fractal Encrypt there, you can see the entire story with it. There's so much more that goes into these things. Taproot addresses and stuff that it's truly amazing.
I'm gonna have Fractal on the show.
Yeah, you should. You definitely should. He will have to stay keep his OPSEC somehow. But if you're listening to this, Fractal, thank you for everything. I mean, I can't wait to see you again, man.
Wow. That's a great story. And I really got to switch gears here, though, just to kind of stay on track a bit. But one angle you took on sort of this whole economic framework and what Bitcoin brings to the table is just what is this promise that government bonds make?
Oh yeah, yeah. That's a an angle too. Like when the Fed prints new dollars, or when they do quantitative easing, they do that in exchange for government bonds. That's how the government gets new dollars. And what is a government bond? It's a promise from the government to pay something back in the future. And how does the government make money? It steals it. It deprives everyone else of their money. So the government can't really make money in any other way than by taxing people. So a government bond, from this angle, is nothing more than a promise by the government to keep on being assholes to your children too. So they are going to be assholes in the future too, and they have assured everyone of this. And funny thing, the government bonds are classified as like the most the most risk-free asset there is a government bond. because the nothing in life is more sure than death and taxes, right? So right. So that's why the government bond is so good at holding value. Anyway, the government promises to be assholes in the future too, in exchange for a permission to dilute the value of your money,
right?
Which you need to use to pay the government in the future more than you could earlier on. So it's a never-ending negative loop for everyone in it. Like it's a truly draconian vortex, if you will, and it's getting worse. So that's bad.
Right. Yeah, I think you summed it up with government bonds ensure forced violence, and it's a promise that the beatings will continue until morale improves, paid for by the enslaved people themselves twice, dilution and taxation. And I think we're kind of saying there that, or you're saying, sort of monetary inflation has replaced existential inflation in a lot of ways. And yeah. It seems to be worse. Does this sort of frame Bitcoin up as a universal authority?
Bitcoin as an authority?
Yeah, sort of the ledger and sort of...
Absolutely not. The opposite. Because it removes the need for that. Because it's just an agreement on a fixed set of rules. It's entirely voluntary. So there's no ruler, there's no divine right, there's no like it takes it all, it removes all of it. So in that sense, I
what about in the sense that it settles disputes?
Yeah, and what was the wording you
authority,
used?
Authority.
Yeah, but to me, an authority is like a person. And Bitcoin is not authoritarian in any sense of the word. It's anti-authoritarian, if anything. I mean, it removes the need for authority by just providing you with information and a fixed, like I said, an agreement on a fixed set of rules. And you get to reap the benefits if you follow the rules. You do not get to reap them if you don't follow the rules. And that's the beauty of the system. So it incentivizes people to follow rules,
right,
without the need for any authority.
Makes sense. I think that was a great answer. And I want to turn to memetics.
I sort of flipped it on its head, but
yeah,
but
then again,
I couldn't think of any better way of thinking about it, because I really, really, really dislike the word authority.
Right.
Speaking
of authority,
why the hell did this guy become a sea captain? That's a follow up question.
Fair enough. You took an interesting look at memetics.
Yeah,
and sort of ideas and memes and how they live and die. And I'd love for you to kind of expand a little bit on the idea of suicide bombing and how that sort of lives on as an idea.
Yeah, this is to make a point that Bitcoin is very much better than suicide bombing, but that even like... And it ties into Jeff's foreword a bit too, I guess, because everything is an idea. Everything in society starts out as an idea. And suicide bombing, how can that have survived evolutionary? Well, bombs haven't existed for that long, but the idea of ritual suicide for the greater good has been around for a long time. I'm not sure of this, but I suspect you can see that in chimpanzees too. I mean, I think this goes way back in our ancestry. And the thing with that is that the single suicidal bomber obviously dies with the act. But the act itself, the idea of doing something like that, lives on, because it makes headlines. It's a spectacular event that gets a lot of attention, and it might get the attention of some other people that are, you know, devoted enough to try something similar themselves, and this is why bad ideas can also live on for a very, very long time in human minds without their at the expense of their host bodies. An idea doesn't have to be good to live on. It can be really harmful to all its users, but can still, you know, help itself survive, if you will.
Right.
And the point I'm trying to make in the book is that Bitcoin has every chance of surviving without being of detriment to its users. It's even good to the host in immeasurable ways. And chances are that the host won't be able to survive without that idea in the future. Right now, Bitcoin wouldn't survive without its hosts, but it might be the other way around, in a not too distant future.
Yeah, the symbiotic relationship that you key in on was really fascinating. You even mentioned that it's a bit terminal, in the sense that knowing is owning and you can take your Bitcoin with you.
And there's no easy way to distinguish you from your Bitcoin. If you have them in your head, you are your Bitcoin. There's no other way of describing that. You're in a symbiotic relationship with them. And I draw a parallel to the movie Venom with Tom Hardy, or like the superhero, supervillain Venom in the Spider-Man universe, which is in a symbiotic relationship with its host as well. And Bitcoin functions the same way. It forces you to form a relationship with this new alien life form. But in the return, the alien life form gives you superpowers. So enjoy the ride, because it's there and it's not going away.
Yeah. A couple of ways I liked how you summed it up is Bitcoin maximalists are the way they are because they've done their homework. The more you can plan ahead, the less barbaric you can afford to be. Time preference is directly connected to civility, and Bitcoin attracts high quality people, but also helps every person become better. And I think there's sort of the symbiotic nature of Bitcoin. Obviously there have been people who probably got into Bitcoin at the top, sold quickly, didn't have any conviction. And for them, the idea is going to die, and maybe even it won't replicate in their future generations. But for the majority of people, it obviously, I think, is going to affect them in a positive way and live on in their hosts, and their hosts are going to replicate. Idea will replicate. It's really a fascinating way to look at it.
Yeah, and Bitcoin maximalism gets a bad name from people that that are easily offended. And of course, there are bad actors in Bitcoin too, and there are. Since Bitcoin enables you to speak your mind freely for the first time, because you don't have to care as much about the social consequences as you have in fiat life, maybe, where you have to be politically correct and woke all the time. As Kurt Cobain put it, the people who showered and brushed their teeth all the time, they didn't realize that was another way to live life. But there's something to that, you get this. Maybe that's what normies see first. They see the don't give a fuck attitude, and they think we're a bunch of maniacs, that are way too provocative. But beneath that surface lies a whole bunch of deep insights that if you get to know a Bitcoiner and if you do your homework.
That was the thing. I mean, I thought it was a bunch of provocative assholes, but I couldn't refute anything they were saying. And I'm just talking about the exactly. ideas that were being put forth. Yeah. And that was what really piqued my interest, because these maxisms were being thrown at me. And I started looking into them because I was like, fuck this shit. I want to refute this guy. I want to refute this girl. This doesn't make sense to me. But I dwelled on it and made sense to me. And the more I looked on it, and then I just kind of kept scratching at that itch, because I kept getting new things I couldn't refute and new ways to look at things. But I wanted to be able to refute it if it didn't make sense or wasn't going to hold water. And so it was kind of the toxicity was sort of to me, logic.
Yeah.
A lot of logic was being thrown at me by somebody who was being snarky about it. But the snarky is just the language of Twitter, the snark. So,
yeah. Yeah. And there's something there's a value to being provocative. When I try to, I don't really try to be provocative. But then again, I don't shy away from it either. I think I've said on other pods and so on in other interviews that my books, I've written them to provoke thought in the reader. And I'd like to provoke thought, but I'm I don't want to, you know, offend or attack anyone in particular. So it's more like, I try to, whenever I write a tweet and then I notice that I called someone out, so like, no, I don't want to do that. I want to talk about ideas, because there's this saying, like, dumb people talk about people, discuss mm-hmm. people, and medium intelligent people talk about, what is it? The weather, about events, and smart people discuss ideas. Right. And that, like, that's where you want to be. And maybe that's provocative to some, but then again, I think it's, if you're communicating to a whole bunch of people, there is no way that you cannot speak without being provocative to someone. Right. And to me, like, wokeism is one of the most provocative things there is, the provocative modes of being there is. I get really provoked by all these self-righteous assholes trying to virtue signal all the time. It's really provoking to me. But I'm never vocal about it, and neither is anyone else who's being provoked by by non-provocative behavior. So there's that whole climate is so skewed anyway, and so fucked up in clown world. So you laughing at it is like, that's the job of the court jester, speak truth to power and be able to make fun of the king and point out that it doesn't have any clothes. So that's not my job, but I've chosen another niche in this, but I certainly see the value in pointing out absurdities and laughing at them instead of like falling for this, you need to be so sensitive to everything. I put out a tweet in Miami. I bet you saw it.
I saw it. I did.
And I like to explain that. We took a photo outside of they were having a LGBTQ parade the same week. Autism week was like 2 weeks later.
Mm.
Well, that was obviously the obvious event to have together with the Bitcoin. Anyway, they didn't. They had this LGBTQ thing. So they have rainbow flags. And I noticed the rainbow flags, and we took a picture where I stand in front of the rainbow flags and say, hey, guys, here's the Ethereum conference.
Right.
And I thought that was funny because, A, they had rainbow flags, and they look sort of like the rainbows that the Ethereum people use, and two, that there were no attendees. It was empty. Mm-hmm. So
right. That was the joke to me. It was empty. That was the joke. I mean the first level that struck me.
And like, to be honest, I did have a hunch that people would be offended by it, but I couldn't really see why that was. After a while, the tweet went sort of semi-viral, and a lot of people got upset, and I had to apologize to all of the LGBTQ community because I didn't want to imply that they were shitcoiners. Because to me, of course, I'm a libertarian. I think you should be free to engage in whatever sexual activity you want to with whomever you want to, whenever you want to, as long as there's mutual consent. And by that, I don't mean signing a paper, but that they're okay with it. So I have no problem with other people doing things. Do whatever the hell you want. But I dislike shitcoins. I admit that.
Yeah, I mean, that was the most interesting aspects of the conference from the speakers, specifically Francis Pouliot, who really honed in on how that crypto, and when I say crypto here, I put it in quotes, and I don't mean cryptographic currencies because I think there's only one, which is Bitcoin, but crypto, the slang, the marketing jargon for shitcoins is the biggest and most lethal attack on Bitcoin. And I agree with that. I think that's, you know, the biggest attack by the state. And I think it's it's insidious because it doesn't look like an attack. It looks like, you know, at worst, it's affinity scamming. But it is so much more than that.
Yeah, and no matter how much any government is involved, it's just awful because it's so deceiving. Like trying to replicate resistance to replicability is, you know, misleading at best, but probably it's way worse than that. And I can tell you an anecdote from the conference. The first day we were walking around and I saw this, some Asian company called Hodlnaut, not Hodlnaut, but Hodlnaut.
Yeah.
And as you probably know, I'm friends with Hodlnaut, the space cat, and he's a dear friend of mine. And I got so offended by them stealing his name like that. So I walk up to this, there's like five Asian guys working there, and walk up to one of them and like, dude, that's not cool. You stole my friend's name and he would not approve of anything you're doing. You say you're a crypto wallet and like it had the word crypto and all the altcoins, blah, 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 everywhere written all over it. And like, and he pretended like he didn't know what I was talking about. And maybe he was right. Maybe it was just some poor employee. So that's what I get offended by, someone trying to steal Hodlnaut's name to sell a shitcoin. I mean,
I saw awful. Those. I think I may have even got one of those t-shirts. That I can't believe they were handing out a hardware wallet upon entry into the festival.
What's that, the Arcturus thing?
Whatever? I mean, that's a major faux pas. In terms of sort of more around the copycatting of Hodlnaut's name and replicability, you know, this was, I really thought, an interesting point you brought up in the book, how inflation is double spending.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. That's like one of the oddball ideas of the book, and it might be taking things too far. And
no, I think it's really on point. And I think you go further, and what I thought really blew my mind was that you can only solve double spending once.
Yeah, when you really think about it, double spending problem isn't solved until it's solved everywhere. When we still have double spending going on, you haven't solved the problem. So until hyper-Bitcoinization happens, or you like every transaction where there's a third party involved is a form of partial double spending. I think it was Hans Hermann Hoppe that coined the term partial barter for fiat transactions. Partial barter, that's the same thing as partial double spending, right? Because someone is double if you have 5% inflation, which you never have, by the way, you have like 15 to 20%, but if you have 5%, then you're every transaction is just 95% of what it should be, and the other 5% goes to a double spender.
Right.
So that's it, and that's why I that problem. Since Bitcoin started with computer nerds a lot, like it started in that sphere, that then all the explanations you hear about this is from the perspective of a computer engineer. And then it becomes a computer networking problem. It's the same with the Byzantines generals problems. It's like all of these things are discussed in terms of what they mean to a computer engineer, or a computer scientist. But that's not the same thing as what they mean to an Austrian economist or to reality. It's the double spending problem can only be solved once in that sense. And that ties into everything else about the resistance to replicability thing.
Yeah.
So even if you could replicate it, and if there was a perfect altcoin that wouldn't ever change, that would still have diluted the potential value of the spending. First. So that it would be literal double spending.
Right. Solving again would be double spending. Yeah. It's mind blowing in that regard.
Yeah. If Bitcoin Cash worked, and if it took if the two chains had split, and they could keep their value exactly the same. So the 50% of the value was in Bitcoin and 50% was in Bitcoin Cash. That would have been double spending. Like, and you would have diluted the, they would both be worth 50% right. of their. Now, fortunately,
especially with the airdrop tied to the original network.
Exactly. And
yeah.
But fortunately enough, markets are clever by themselves because they sort this thing out, and now Bitcoin Bcash trash is worth trash, and Bitcoin is worth like more than 99% of what that is worth. So the market figured it out. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, I think I like how you framed it up as there can only be one deflationary currency. An absolute scarcity in a digital asset is resistant to replicability.
Yeah, and this ties back to Jeff Booth, because he wrote his book, The Price of Tomorrow, and he had thought a lot about inflation and deflation, and he had come to the conclusion that there can only be one deflationary type of money, but he had not yet figured out that Bitcoin was that only thing. That insight came later, which I think is so fascinating, because to me and to most Bitcoiners it was the other way around. We started thinking about Bitcoin, and then maybe at some point we realized that there can only be one deflationary currency. But all this is tied together to this resistance to replicability thought. The double spending problem can only be solved once. Absolute digital scarcity can only be discovered once. There can only be one deflationary currency. If there are more than one, they're not deflationary anymore. That's right. simple thing. And this also leads to the very abstract idea of hyper-Bitcoinization being the literal inverse of hyperinflation, like one divided by hyperinflation, which means that it's on a hockey stick curve and gets weirder and weirder over time, which even I have a hard time wrapping my head around.
Yeah, you get into a little bit of... the S curve versus J curve price adoption.
Yeah, I do.
And it seems like you lean heavily towards J curve. And what I thought was interesting there was not only that thought, but how you see that as maybe better for humanity, that maybe relentless adoption is and quicker adoption is better for humanity.
Yeah, because we hear the opposite narrative so often that the faster this goes, the more violent it's going to get. But think about what it is like. It's voluntary interaction. It's nothing more than that. And the more voluntary interaction we have between each other, the less involuntary interaction. So it steals the power from the violent actors and gives it to the non-violent actors. And the faster that process goes, the better it is for everyone. I have a hard time seeing it any other way, because like, what do they mean? Like, if this is slower, in what way is that better? So that the government gets to steal more, or like, so that people get thrown in jail more? I don't get it. What's bad about the fast adoption? Can someone give me a good counter argument here? Because I haven't seen one yet. It's like people are afraid of a fast change, but it's a change into something unchangeable, which is always preferable to something that changes a lot. So we're already in a system that changes a lot, that changes the rules all the time. So if we can all voluntarily hop onto something that doesn't change, how is that a violent change? I don't see that.
Right. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And another interesting point you bring up around sort of value and hyper-Bitcoinization is twofold. After this point, people will no longer measure Bitcoin in dollars, but dollars in Bitcoin. And this is something that was really interesting, is that the world is worth everything that money can buy twice. The money itself is worth just as much.
Yeah, or... or half, depending on how you look
sure.
at it.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing in the end. Like it doesn't matter. Half or twice, there will be 21 million on one side and all the stuff on the other side.
Right. Yeah. That I thought was really interesting. And my final question to you is, how is the word we the most dangerous word in the world?
I put that in there somewhere. I don't know what context I put that in the book. Do you have a quote or something? Because, like, I think it has something to do with the word "we" implies that there's a them somewhere, us and them, or like the word "we" implies that you should do something for a collective cause rather than an individual choice or something like that.
I don't have a quote for you offhand. That's an option. I usually have more context to my notes.
Anyway, the word "we" is dangerous because it can be used as a tool against us. That would be my like on top of my head answer right now. I know. I've written a lot about the word "we" and collectivism in the past, but like. The Bitcoin is, like I said, it's an agreement between people on a fixed set of rules, which means that we do agree and we appreciate each other and we connect and we're a we. I'm using the word "we" all the time here because it's a good word in the context of a voluntary choice that each one of us has made. So if "we" consists of a lot of "I"s, then it's a lot of "me"s, then and a lot of "me" and "you"s, then it's correct. But if "we" is imposed of you by someone else stealing the meaning of the word, then it's very dangerous. We the people of Sweden, or we the people of the US, I didn't put up those borders,
right?
That wasn't voluntary.
Yeah, that "we" can get you to do many dangerous things to yourself,
in
terms of sort of burial rights and life after death and war and sort of that collectivism.
Exactly. I have to tell you a side story here. While working at the tour ship, we visited the landing zone in Normandy in northern France, where a lot of young Americans gave their lives to liberate Europe from Nazi Germany. A very noble thing to do. So there's a piece of northern France that is owned by the US, and it's a graveyard in Normandy. So you walk into this graveyard where there's thousands upon thousands of crosses and the occasional Jewish star. So, and all of these are people that gave their lives history tells us they gave their lives for freedom, but we don't really know. No one can ever know the motives of any actor in any war, the true motives. Sure. But what I found so interesting was that in order to get into this zone owned by the free world, and the home of the brave, where they could show the rest of the world that they had liberated us from totalitarianism, you had to walk through one of those scanners, and had to be, you know, it was just like being at the airport,
right?
Having your privacy invaded. By all these security guards and everything. And I found that so ironic, like liberated from what exactly?
Right.
And aren't we repeating the same mistake over and over and over again? Isn't that all that we're doing? And then you have all these gravestones, like if these people didn't believe in this cross or this star here, they wouldn't have given their lives, and neither would the guys on the German side for that matter. So,
right.
Yeah.
It's
to me, it's all bad war.
Interesting anecdote from that war that I've heard is sometime around Christmas, like I think the French and the German soldiers just paused the war and celebrated together.
Yeah, which
is human.
So telling. It's telling.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of like teams on a football field or a soccer field putting on a jersey and declaring animosity. Yeah. War is a whole other thing to unpack.
Yeah.
But speaking about Bitcoin, everything divided by 21 million, your latest book, the final quote I'll roll out to is abundance in money equals scarcity in everything else. And conversely, scarcity in money equals abundance everywhere. Or as Knut so eloquently describes, everything divided by 21 million. As always, I can't tell you how much I enjoy our conversations. I already look forward to the next one. Please let people know where they could find you and your work. And of course, your latest book.
Yeah, most of my Bitcoin content is on Twitter, where I'm at Knut Svanholm. And you can find this book. I highly recommend you order it directly from the publishing house, Consensus Network. You'll find it in my Twitter profile. Otherwise, you can buy it from Amazon. There's now a hardcover version available, and an Audible version is coming very soon. I hear Guys One has a sore throat, so he had to take a break from it for a while, but he'll be on it as soon as he gets his voice back. Where else? Keep your eyes peeled, or keep your eyes open, because there's some more stuff coming. I have some stuff to announce a couple of weeks from now. Next week I'll be in Madrid on the 10th, attending a meetup with a bunch of books. So if you're in Madrid, that is happening.
Awesome.
After that, I think I'm going to Madeira for a couple of days. That's what's happening in the near future for me. Other than that, the other thing I have planned is to go to Riga and Baltic Honey Badger in September. But more than that, it's more open.
I recommend people pick up the latest book and the others as well. It's a great book to read by the fire or the fireplace, or by a lake. I'll read a little piece from Jeff Booth. We're all chained to the unforgiving arrow of time. We're born, we live, and we get old. At least that's what we hope will happen. Then we die. None of us humans are millionaires in terms of hours, yet we sacrifice our most valuable and scarce asset just to stay alive in the hamster's wheel one more day. In pursuit of saving time, Satoshi stumbled upon a discovery of a new, weightless, absolutely scarce element. The showstopper for each and every time thief, element zero, Bitcoin. Bitcoin's limited supply cap is the immovable object that enables us all to become an unstoppable force. Because the truth is, the system is us. Each of our actions in choosing, in turn, changes our world. It is how ideas we once couldn't see turn into reality, one person at a time.
It's some of that the last. The last few sentences is Jeff, but Jeff's, the rest is me.
Yes, I apologize for that. Very powerful words. A lot to ponder here, Knut, as usual. Another tour de force. So,
thank you. Thank chatting. You. I love that you enjoyed the book. I'm very happy you did, and I hope it's on par with the other two. And
it definitely is.
To anyone who read it, please leave a review on Amazon, because that really helps.
Yeah, of course, definitely. Thank you so much, Knut. It's been dope.
Thank you, Sid. See you.
This episode was brought to you by CipherSafe and Ledin. If you enjoy the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, please tell your friends and family about the show. And I also ask that you write a 5-star review on your podcast platform. That is really the best couple of ways to help the show gain awareness, grow, and become sustainable. And thank you for listening. Stack Sats, stay humble, and stay laser focused. This is Cedric. Peace.